Hey everybody, this is Rue. Just a quick word before today's episode. As you may or may not know, I had some computer problems this week, and that's why the episode is coming out a couple days late. I do apologize, I try to avoid these type of problems at all costs, but my PC was overheating, so I had to fix it. But I got a new air cooler installed, we are not going back to water cooling after all those issues, and we should be good to go. So, with that being said, sit back and enjoy the episode. Clear skies! Astrocast. I'm your host, Rue. Today is Tuesday, April 16th. We're about halfway into a new moon, and it's starting to brighten up the skies quite a bit. Luckily, when I was out this morning, it had already set. I got up around, I think I was around 4:30 a.m. this morning. I looked at the clock and I saw it was clear, so I said, what the heck? I've been doing that quite a bit lately. I find as it gets closer and closer to the summer months and nebula season, I just can't help myself. I do the same thing when fall starts to get closer and I know that Orion is sitting out there in the sky at, 4 o'clock in the morning. I just can't help myself. I got to get up and see. And when I know Cygnus and Aquila are out there just waiting for me in the summer triangle, I just have to go look. So one thing that I have always challenged you guys to do is to learn a new constellation every season. And this season has been no different for me. And one of the new ones that I learned recently was Corvus. Corvus is the crow, and he was actually Apollo's crow in Greek mythology. And it's a pretty recognizable one. If you see it, you'll probably know it. I know that I had seen the asterism, if you will, hundreds of times, but just didn't really know what it was. And when I was sitting outside one night last week, I was like, what is that? And, that happens all the time. And it's really a good idea to have a planetarium app on your phone. So when that happens to you, you can pull it out and have a quick look. And, if you're like me, you want to know. And, I like Sky Safari Pro. I also have Stellarium Mobile on my phone as well. So, whatever you like, you can use. There's a ton of great apps out there for finding what's in the night sky, of course. But I pulled it out and had a look, and sure enough, it was Corvus. And Corvus sits kind of low on the southern horizon this time of year. I guess around 10 or 11 o'clock at night is when I saw it. And really cool, smaller constellation. I think it was around 70th place as far as size is concerned. So kind of small. And I actually took up kind of a new hobby with astronomy. And this is something that I'm going to talk about with you today. It's something that I had heard discussed often, and I never really understood it until I did it. And now I got to say, after doing it just a couple of times, I completely get it. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But the other one that I've recently learned, and I am thrilled to learn because I'm a big birder, so I'm a huge fan of birds. You may not know this, but we actually have an African gray parrot. His name is Zachary Bird. And I love doing birding in nature as well. That's actually what got me into photography originally. And then when I got into photography, that led me to astronomy. And, that's kind of how I'm sitting here right now talking to you. So I owe quite a lot to birds. So Cygnus is obviously one of my favorite constellations. Cygnus the Swan is in the summer triangle, which is a asterism that is in the summer night sky. It's made up of three very bright stars. That would be Vega, Deneb, and I can never remember the last one, Altair. So those three stars make up the summer triangle. And if you're ever out on a summer night, or if you're out at, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning right now, in the northern hemisphere, and you look up, you should see the summer triangle very clearly. It'll be, you know, pretty much right overhead. I guess around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, it's still on the eastern side of the sky right now. But in the summertime, it, you know, it's the big thing that you see overhead. And it's always easy to find Vega because it's so bright. But anyway, Cygnus the Swan is kind of the first summer constellation that I feel like a lot of people learn. If you don't know it yet, I highly recommend learning it. Deneb is kind of the bright star in that region. You also have Satyr is another one that's in the constellation of Cygnus. And there's a lot of very popular nebula in that region, including obviously the Satyr region. You have the wall, I can't remember if it's the Cygnus wall or the Satyr wall. I can never remember exactly how they call it. The Crescent Nebula is also in that region. Just a ton of really cool nebula and nebulosity to be found in that constellation and in the surrounding area. So definitely one worth learning. I think the North American Nebula is also right in that vicinity. So definitely check that one out. But the other constellation that I recently learned that is also a part of the Summer Triangle and is actually where Altair lies is Aquila. And the reason I was so thrilled to learn it is because I didn't realize Aquila is another bird. So I knew Cygnus was a swan, but Aquila is another bird constellation. And when you look at Aquila, you actually realize that it looks very similar to Cygnus in the way that it's shaped, but flying in at a different direction. And it's super easy to memorize once you kind of, if you know Cygnus, you know, really well, and it's easy for you to pick out in the night sky. If you look, you know, down and to the right, you know, depending on what time of night it is, and you see Altair down there, it's very easy to kind of spot the spread wings and then the tail in the back that makes up Aquila. So that was the other one that I learned besides Corvus. So I learned two new bird constellations. Obviously, one's a spring target and one is a summer target, but it's always good to learn new constellations. And that is going to take us to our first topic for today. So we were at Barnes and Noble a couple weeks ago, me and my wife were, and we love going to Barnes and Noble. We're both big readers and we love bookstores. I own a Kindle, but I don't really touch it much, to be honest. She reads her Kindle a lot, but I don't touch mine very often. If I'm not listening to an audiobook, I would prefer to have a physical book. Although truth be told, 95% of the time I'm listening to an audiobook. Nonetheless, I love browsing through a bookstore. Sometimes I'll just get ideas for audiobooks and then I'll go get them on Audible. Nonetheless, we were in Barnes & Noble and I noticed that they had a really cool section for notebooks. And I had been looking for a nice notebook for a little while. And I had a couple older notebooks that I used for various things, like one for work notes. And then I had a birding journal for, you know, various species that I saw out in the field while I was out doing birding photography, et cetera. But I really wanted one just for my kind of personal use. And I wasn't really even sure what I was going to use it for yet, but I wanted to get a little notebook that I could just use myself. So I was looking through them all. And I came across a Moleskine notebook, which I understand are extremely popular because they're really well made and they are known to last for a very long time, et cetera, et cetera. So after looking through a bunch of them, I picked one of the smaller sized ones because I wanted something that I could, you know, easily carry with me all the time. So I went ahead and grabbed it up, not even knowing what I was going to write in it. And a couple days ago, I was thinking about the fact that I had learned Corvus, and I was telling my buddy Chris about how, you know, I recommend everybody learn a new constellation once per season, at least. I mean, if you can, I always say learn more, but one per season is a good realistic number to aim for that I think everybody should be able to achieve. And it's cool to learn the names of the major stars in the constellations too, if you can, particularly if they're very bright stars that are easy to pick out from, you know, say a Bortle 6 or 7 sky like I am in, and, you know, suburban skies. It's good, you know, it exercises your brain, it keeps you engaged, and you look like a really cool astronomy nerd if you ever, you know, have friends by that don't really know much about it. You can kind of point up to the sky and start naming stars and constellations, and their jaw will drop after you name a dozen or so. But anyway, I'm rambling now. The Moleskin Notebook. I decided one of the cool ways to use this would be to start sketching out constellations inside of it. So the first one that I did was Corvus. So what I did is while I was sitting out in the yard, I actually drew out the four stars that I could see. And I just had a small ruler. It wasn't even a ruler, truth be told. It was just a little straight edge piece of what are these things? Adhesive tabs, like the little 3M command hooks, the Velcro side, but it had a perfect straight edge and it was the right size for the small notebook that I was using. So I used that to draw a straight line between the stars where it was appropriate after I referenced the correct lines of the constellation in the Sky Safari app. And then I kind of lightly drew the picture of the crow over it where it would be, according to the, you know, the Greek artwork. And then later on, when I was back at my computer, I looked up Corvus to find some facts on it. And I found the names of all the stars, you know, the brightest ones, obviously, that are within. And I wrote down the three stars that had you know, the three brightest stars in the constellation. And then I wrote down the magnitude of the brightest star, the location of the three. I wrote down the right ascension and declination of the brightest star. And then just a couple little facts about Corvus. And then I did the same thing with Aquila, which was really cool. I didn't draw the bird over Aquila just because it had more stars and I wasn't quite as confident drawing. I'm not a great artist, to be clear, but you don't really have to be for this. I literally was drawing like a, you know, X marks the spot for the brightest stars and then just little dots basically to denote the other stars. Thicker dots for brighter stars, smaller dots for less bright stars. And if you want to know which ones are brighter and which ones are not as bright, just look in Stellarium or you can look in, you know, Sky Safari or any of the apps. They will easily denote which ones are brighter and which ones are less bright. And the idea here is that I can start adding one, you know, whenever I'm out and I see something and I'm like, hey, what is that? In fact, I can go back and add all the ones that I already know. But I don't necessarily know all of the stars within. I know a lot of them, but I don't know all of them. And that is an excellent way to commit this stuff to memory, because if you're like me, a really good way to commit things to memory is to write them down and be able to, you know, study them and then reference back later. Because if I don't see something two or three times in my own handwriting, I have a really hard time grasping it and pulling it out of the back of my head later on. For example, like when I'm at the office, you know, and I'm in a meeting, like I have to take notes. Like I'm a religious note taker. If you saw my one note, you'd be like, oh my God, look at this, because it's just pages and pages and pages of notes. And I do that because that's the way I learn. And you may or may not be that way, but I would be willing to bet that if you looked up at the night sky, you know, and then 3 months later, I said, hey, what was the, third brightest star in that constellation that you learned over the winter? you might not remember necessarily, but if you had your moleskin notebook or whatever kind of notebook that you wanted to get, and you could just pull that out and flip open to whatever page it was that you wrote that constellation down on, you'd be able to do it. And I think this could extend to a lot of different stuff, because as I understand it, people sketch nebula and all kinds of, you know, awesome things. They sketch galaxies. I don't know if I'll go that deep or not, but I suppose that it's right there for the taking if I want to. It's just as simple as, you know, doing as much or as little as I want. And I found it funny because I'd heard of people sketching the stars so many times over the years. And I was just like, why would you do that? That's just what I always said kind of to myself. I never said it aloud when someone mentioned it. But now it clicked for me. I'm like, oh, because it commits it to memory and you can kind of learn more and you can learn these stars and you can learn these constellations. And I would imagine you can learn the galaxies more and you can learn the stars within the galaxies and you can learn the nebula better. And if you're like me and you don't do astronomy and astrophotography just for the pretty pictures that we get. Don't get me wrong. I love the pretty pictures that we get, but I also really love learning about the universe around us. This is just another arrow in my quiver that I can use on my journey to more knowledge. And I hope that this is something that I can share with you that might inspire you to give it a try, because like I say, up till last week, it had never even occurred to me to think of doing it, but I'm kind of excited to fill this book out now because it's got all these empty pages in here. And I was thinking about, you know, the upcoming year and all of the different seasons that we go through and just how many different constellations show up throughout the year. And, you know, how many small ones there are, how many big ones there are. I mean, when you start talking about like the winter canvas, as I like to call it, with Taurus and Orion, the Pleiades and the, you know, the twins of Gemini, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that right there could take you, you know, days to fill up. And this is something you don't necessarily have to do it while you're, you know, out under the stars. You certainly can, but you don't have to. If it's a constellation you already know, you could certainly, you know, pull it up on your app and then draw it down just so you can start committing those stars to memory. So whatever way you want to do it, you know, there's no right or wrong way to do this. And that's kind of the beauty of it. So I wanted to talk about that because it was something that I have really enjoyed doing. Like I say, I'm only a couple in, but it's pretty awesome. So I wanted to share it with you guys and just get you caught up on that. So that was a pretty cool win for the last week for me. Galaxy season just seems to be flying by. I don't know if you guys think so, but I sure do. I'm kind of happy about that, to be frank, because I'm hoping by next year I will have a telescope worthy of galaxy season with enough focal length. I certainly will have a camera capable of it now. After looking through Stellarium over the last week, if you listened to last week's episode, you may know that I have pre-ordered an ASI 585 MC Pro, which has a much more cropped in field of view than my 294 MC Pro does. So that's going to give me a much closer view than I would otherwise get with my other camera. So if I end up getting something with a longer focal length, I think that's going to end up working great for things like galaxies and planetary nebulae. So, you know, I'm hoping by this time next year I can finagle myself a new mount and a, you know, telescope that is worthy of looking at smaller telescopes. Not telescopes, galaxies. But if I don't, I can always use my observatories because we have some really awesome, very capable telescopes. I actually need to get with the observatory director because I have yet to do the training on one of our best telescopes that is extremely capable of imaging smaller galaxies. And it only would take about 30 minutes, but I just haven't set it up with him yet. So that's something that I really need to do. But other than that, I am quite happy that Galaxy season will be coming to a close fairly soon. I looked at my countdown timer today and I am 55 days away from our second annual Dark Sky trip. So very excited about that. In other cool Astrocast news, NEEF is coming up, I guess this weekend. I ordered cards for the Astrocast, which is pretty cool because after talking with the guys at Dark Dragons Astronomy, they are going to be dropping cards for the Astrocast into their loot bags that they're going to be giving away at the show. And there's going to be a ton of vendors and consumers there as well. So they're going to help spread the word of the show, which I am extremely grateful for. So another shout out to them. I think we're going to be able to do a lot of awesome work together with those guys. So very excited about that. I don't know. I got like 500 of those cards. So it's pretty cool, though. I got the logo for the show on the front of the card, my email address, obviously, QR code that takes you to the podcast. And then the back of the card has one of my all-time favorite photos that I've taken, which is me and my oldest friend in the world. I'm pointing up at the sky and he's looking at the sky. It's our silhouettes and the Milky Ways in the background. It was one of the first shots we took when we took our Dark Sky trip last year. So that's pretty cool. I'm also working on kind of a big episode that I am planning on releasing in the next couple weeks. It's going to be my Pix Insight episode. I know I talked about that a few episodes back. I just haven't had the time to put the proper research and time into it that I need to. And this is not one that I just want to wing and kind of half do. I want to do it properly for you guys and give you my exact workflow and really break it down in a thorough way that you deserve. So that will be coming in the next few weeks. So if you have been wondering about Pix Insight, if you haven't used Pix Insight before and you're thinking about, you know, jumping on that bandwagon, stay tuned for that because I'm going to have a whole lot more to say about that in the coming months. Back in one of the earliest episodes, it might have even been the first or second episode, we did go over pricing for Pix Insight. So that's something that we have covered, but we haven't actually covered workflow yet. Not much anyway. I think we touched on some very basic stuff, but I'm going to cover workflow from top to bottom in one of the coming episodes. So we do have that to look forward to as well. I'm curious what you guys spend on your let's say your software charges every month, because I was thinking about this the other day. Obviously, I think I'm a little bit of a, let's say, a rare case, just because obviously I have this podcast to do. So I end up paying for the whole suite of Adobe tools. I would pay for, I guess, Lightroom and Photoshop either way. So I suppose I could just go with the photography suite, as they call it, which is, I think, $20 per month if you just get that. But being that I do the podcast and I do occasionally do video stuff as well, I need access to Audition and also Premiere Pro. And then obviously I've purchased all the astrophotography tools over the last couple of years. I started with Astrophotography Pixel Processor, APP. Or is it AstroPixel Processor? I'm forgetting the names of all these programs. And then obviously I got Pix Insight and Blur Exterminator and Noise Exterminator and all of the various exterminator tools that RC Astro has. And, you know, it's a lot of money and the monthly charges are a bit much. I know I'm living in La La Land, but I sure wish Adobe still sold their software outright. I know they'll never do that when they can get monthly charges from us all and just keep raking it in year after year. But do you guys remember a time when you could just buy Photoshop outright? If you're one of the younger listeners, you probably don't remember that. But there was a time when you could go to like a place called CompUSA. It was a store that existed back in the 90s and I guess early 2000s. And they sold boxes of software, just a literal box. And they had these huge manuals in them that would show you how to use the software, and you could pay $60 for a piece of software. I think, you know, Photoshop was probably a little bit pricier, maybe $100 or $200. I can't remember, but you would just buy a copy of it, and then you owned it forever. And you could use it as long as you wanted. You owned the license for it, and it was wonderful. But boy, oh boy, are those days ever gone. And I just really hope that PixInsight doesn't move to a model like that. I know that they are going to be doing, and at some point in the future, rumor has it that they will be doing a, you know, big 2.0 update at some point. And there will be a discount for users who have already, you know, purchased the 1.0 software. Or obviously, they're up to like 1.8 now. But basically, people who have previously purchased PixInsight will get a significant discount on the 2.0 upgrade versus users who are brand new coming in and buying 2.0. But I could certainly see it going either way, where they could move to a monthly subscription model too. And I really hope that isn't the case, because, man, I have had it up to my ears in monthly subscription fees, as I'm sure we all have. When I first cut the cord from cable, I was so thrilled at the lack of bills. And, you know, cable, my in-laws down the street, my mother-in-law, she would gladly cut the cord. She is very tech savvy and is perfectly capable of using something like a Chromecast and just streaming all of her content from her phone. But my father-in-law loves his DVR and his remote control and his live TV. And I think they pay something like $350 a month because they have to get the whole bundle package with the internet and the DVR and blah, blah, blah. I know this isn't about astronomy, I'm sorry, but my point being, we had to get away from all that because it was, you know, $350 a month that we were paying. But now all these services are split up and they're all so expensive that we're getting closer and closer to paying hundreds of dollars a month for all the services that we need. And yeah, it's a lot, unless you want to be a pirate. And I, you know, when I was younger in my 20s, I did that, but I don't do that anymore just because I don't think it's right to do that, to steal from, you know, content creators. I'm a content creator myself, so I don't think that's right. So I don't do that. But yeah, anyway, I'll get off my pedestal now and we can get back to astronomy. So I saw Agena Astro. I'm not sure if any of the other big sites like High Point Scientific or the others are doing it, but Agena Astro is doing a really good deal on the AM5 and the AM3, which, if you don't know, those are ZWO's harmonic drive mounts. They're kind of like the mount everyone wants for the last year. If you're a ZWO fan, I know that there's people that have a lot of mixed feelings on ZWO, and I definitely understand that. But if you have been in the market for a AM5 or an AM3 mount, and you do not already own a tripod that you would use for said mount, now would be an excellent time to purchase one, because they're basically giving you the carbon fiber, very nice tripod that they make for the AM3 and the AM5 for free right now if you purchase either one of those. So I wanted to mention that on the show in case anybody is thinking or has been waiting for a good deal to get that set up. Now'd be a good time to do it. So I think it's like $300 difference between the AM3 and the AM5. Here, let me check real quick. Okay, so it's $19.99 for the AM5 that comes with the free tripod. And I think that's normally $300 more. And then $14.99 for the AM3 with the tripod. But it looks like that one's already sold out. So I don't know if they'll do a back order situation. You could certainly reach out to them and ask if you were looking for the AM3. Personally, I don't know why anyone would go with the AM3 when you get the AM5 for just a few hundred more. Just because it's so much more capable with its weight. It can go to up to 44 pounds if you have a counterweight. So that is a wide range of telescopes that you can put on that. I think with 44 pounds, you could go up to like a C8, if I'm not mistaken, which is a pretty large telescope. You could certainly do like a Ritchie Crichton or a good size Rassascope. You know, it gives you a lot of options. So 44 pounds, excellent payload capacity. My current mount, my big mount, if you will, is a CEM 26, which is not a big mount. It's actually well loved for its portability because it's so lightweight. It is super easy to travel with. And honestly, it's been an awesome mount. I've loved it since day one. I probably will need to send it in for maintenance before too much longer because I think I'm coming up on, this will be my third summer with it, if I'm not mistaken. So I probably want to get the belts changed and just get a tune up on it before too much longer. And I've noticed, although I still get very good sharp stars, the guiding numbers aren't as good as I see on a lot of other folks that post on the iOptron groups as what they get. I know, and let me be the first to tell you, guiding numbers really don't mean everything. If you're getting sharp stars, that's really what counts. But I think we all get guiding number envy from time to time. And I just like to make sure that my gear is operating at its best efficiency. And as such, I will likely send it in for maintenance before too much longer. So in other news, my brother Josh reached out to me last week. He travels a lot for his work. He's an engineer and he works in several different factories across America, but actually he's in Baltimore a whole lot. And believe it or not, he was actually, he works at the factory that is right beside the bridge that collapsed in Baltimore. He actually drives over that bridge most mornings on his way to work. Luckily he was not in Baltimore at the time that it collapsed. So he is perfectly fine. But he reached out to me last week because he ran into somebody who he said looked like me and we got a talk in. And he's a big fan of my work as far as astronomy goes. He's actually bought a couple of prints from me and he wants me to get him a really cool shot of Polaris because he's a big fan of the North Star. And that is a very special project that I'm going to be working on for him when we go make our dark sky trip, because I'm not going to take just any shot of Polaris for him. I'm going to take the shot of Polaris for him. If you're big into astronomy, you might know that Polaris isn't particularly interesting. As it sits, if you're in normal suburban skies, it's just, you know, the 46th brightest star in the night sky. I believe it's 46. So not particularly interesting. There's not any nebula in its direct vicinity, if I'm not mistaken. But if you get out to some really dark skies, you can pick up some dust in the area. And I got some plans to make for a really cool shot for that one. But he was talking to me about astronomy, and he said that he's got a lot of travel points racked up on his, credit card from all of his traveling back and forth for work. And he actually offered to take me on a trip over the summer out to Idaho, central Idaho. And I wasn't really aware of Idaho being a great dark sky site. But apparently it is a phenomenal dark sky reserve, and it's actually an international dark sky reserve, and has some of the best views of the Milky Way and the entire country. Their particular place that we are looking at is called Little Redfish Lake, and apparently it's a good way outside of civilization, so we would have to basically fly into Idaho, I don't know where, and he said we would get into a hotel and then basically hike in 3 or 4 hours to get to the really dark site. And we'd want to stay, I told him, like, if we're going to do that, we want to stay at least 3 nights, so we'd probably camp out for 3 nights. Which I think would be awesome, particularly at that elevation, because it looks like it's around 6,500 feet. I have been to Bortle 1 skies before, but only at sea level. So I have not been to Bortle 1 at high elevation yet. And it's my understanding that Bortle 1 at high elevation is like a whole other ball game. And that is where I believe you can see zodiacal light very, very well. Unfortunately, I didn't get to look for zodiacal light last year when I was at the dark sky site because we were in a situation where we had to pack up before sunrise, basically. This year, we're going to be able to stay all the way through to sunrise, so I am definitely going to be looking for it. But if we end up doing this Idaho trip a little bit later in the summer, I will definitely be looking for zodiacal light. So we got to confirm a few things, and I got to, you know, look at the travel arrangements and figure out all the details, obviously. But if we went, I would definitely want to go during Milky Way season. So it would have to be over this summer, and I would want to go before the Milky Way gets too low. So, you know, ideally, you know, before late September or early September. I mean, I would think like July or August would probably be the best time to go. So that's something super excited. So I don't know if he was drinking that night. He's known to do a little bit of drinking and talking, but I am going to send him this episode, and I'm going to hold you to the fire on that one, Josh, because you don't message me talking about I'll take you to the darkest spot in the United States, and don't expect me to not take you up on it, man, because I love me some dark skies. It's my absolute favorite thing to do is go to a dark sky site and see the Milky Way. If you've never had a chance to do it, you need to do it. I've probably said this more times than anything else that I've said on this podcast, but seeing the Milky Way is something that everybody needs to experience several times in their lifetime. And I'm telling you this because I'm 39 years old and I saw it for the first time at 38. Yes, 38 years old. And I am, you know, not somebody who is a big indoors guy. And I grew up in a pretty, you know, rural area, all things considered. But I didn't know what to look for when I was a kid. I probably could have seen the Milky Way where I grew up out in Mint Hill, North Carolina, you know, dark skies out there when I was a kid for sure. Because if you drive 3 miles down the road from where I grew up now, you can still see the Milky Way to this day. It's faint, but you can see it. So when I was a kid, you know, 30 years ago, I guarantee you could see it. But I just didn't really know to look for it because I wasn't into astronomy back then. And nobody I ever met said, hey, check that out, you know. So the first time I saw it was when I was 38 years old and I was able to travel somewhere dark enough to actually see it. So I would imagine a lot of people haven't actually laid eyes on it themselves. And you really should at some point, because it's something that changes you a lot, like seeing that solar eclipse that a lot of us got to see last week. It's a special experience. It humbles you in a way that few things do in this world. You can look up at the night sky and you can see the stars and you feel really small when you really come to terms with that and you really realize what you're looking at. But when you see the Milky Way and then you like really realize that that is just one piece of the spiral arm of our galaxy that you're seeing, that really makes you feel small. And it kind of just, it puts a perspective on things that I find to be really beautiful. So something that I highly recommend you do. If you haven't done it in a long time, maybe this summer might be a time when you can do it. If you can find a Bortle 4 or darker sky site, you should be able to get a pretty darn good look at the Milky Way on a night with decent seeing. So a couple of things to note. I've said it before, but I'll say it again. The Bortle scale is how we determine how dark the skies are. So it's a 1 through 10 scale, where 1 is the best dark skies you've ever seen, and 10 is the middle of Manhattan in Times Square with every light on, and you can't even see anything, you know, maybe the planets, and that's about it. So most people live in the, you know, 6 to 8 range. I live just outside of the city in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'm in a Bortle 6-7. I think it's closer to a 7 at this point because it's getting brighter all the time. But if you go to lightpollutionmap.info, and I'll drop the link in the show notes. You can look and find an area close by. You're going to look for a green part on the map. And if you drive there on a night with new moon, it's really important that you go during new moon, because if the moon's up, the Milky Way is so faint, you won't be able to see it. You don't even want to go when it's like a quarter of the moon, because the Milky Way is very delicate and the moon will wash it out. Maybe if you're like in a Bortle 1 area, you could still see it with a little bit of the moon, but I wouldn't bother if there was any moon, because you'll just be taking away from its majesty. So go during new moon, find a green area on that map, on the light pollution map, and just go. I've found with most cities and most areas, because I've looked on this map a lot, within an hour or two's drive, you should be able to find an area with relatively dark skies. So, unless you're in like a huge city and it takes you a long time to get out of Dodge, you should be able to go see some dark skies with a relatively small road trip. And if you got a couple of friends that can go with you, or your significant other, even better, because they will definitely enjoy it. I promise you that, especially if there's someone who's never seen it before. Don't even tell them you're going. Just say you got a surprise for them. You know, make sure it's new moon. Make sure the weather is good and clear. Seeing, I mentioned that earlier. Seeing is basically how much atmospheric disturbance there is on any given night. So there's a few ways that you can determine this. The best way is to just download an app that tells you how the seeing is. There's a ton of them. They have them for iOS. They have them for Android as well. I'll link one for both Android and iOS in the show notes. But basically, a good way to think of it is like how much humidity is in the atmosphere any given night. Because when there's a lot of humidity in the atmosphere, the light that comes through our night sky refracts off of that water. And if you've ever seen stars that look kind of hazy and they're sparkling a lot, like twinkling stars, that would be bad seeing. If you've ever seen like really high atmospheric clouds, that's bad seeing. So it's still technically clear out, but it just doesn't look that clear. That's bad seeing. And that's why people always say winter is a better time to see the night sky, because in the winter, it's usually drier. There's usually less humidity in the sky and we get better seeing conditions. And that's why even in places that have more light pollution, you can often have a lot better conditions, darker skies, or seemingly darker skies, because there's less stuff in the air for that light to bounce off of and kind of, fudge up your view, basically. So good seeing is important. It's not absolutely crucial to see the Milky Way, to be clear. But if you can go on a night when there's really good seeing, it just makes it that much better. So new moon, good seeing, clear skies, and you will be a happy camper. So try to do yourself a favor. And, once June rolls around, in June, it'll be well into the sky by about 11 or 12 o'clock at night. July, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And then, as the summer goes on earlier and earlier, the Milky Way is going to be higher and higher. And you can always check an app to see how high up it is in the sky. Do yourself a favor and check it out this summer. Please do it for Rue. One other little quick announcement I wanted to make: our Patreon. I'm going to make a little change to it. After doing some thinking and listening to a bunch of my other favorite podcasts and YouTube channels, we are going to be adding an additional tier to the Patreon, and it's going to be the Happy Dude tier. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever watched The Simpsons, but I am a giant Simpsons fan. And there's an episode where Homer basically steals an auto dialer, and everybody in Springfield receives a call from him. And it basically says, you have reached Happy Dude. Send me $1 to feel happy. So if you would like to join the Astrocast Society at the Happy Dude level for $1 a month, you can support the show, and we will be putting all of that money directly towards advertising for the show so we can grow the podcast. That's all that it goes towards at this point. If we end up growing the base and we get, you know, a lot more subscribers at some point, then obviously we can review that in the future. As of right now, we have one Patreon subscriber, and it's a little bit lonely in there. So I would love to get a few more of you listeners on board. In the future, I am planning on having a Discord meetup for all of the listeners. So I'd love to have more than one listener there for the Discord meetup. But if we don't have anyone else join, I will certainly still be doing that Discord meetup nonetheless. So if you want to check that out, I will have the Patreon link in the show notes. And like I say, just $1 a month if you want to join, and you'll get a shout out on the episode. You'll be able to join in on our Patreon meetup. And I'm also going to be doing some live streams and some other cool stuff if you want to join in. If you don't, no problem at all. I completely understand. But if you got an extra buck to spare, that would be awesome, because I'm trying to get a little bit of advertising behind the show. We're doing very good. To be clear, we are, you know, pretty consistently over 1,000 listeners at this point. But I feel like we could be doing more, because when I look at a lot of the other shows that are in the science and tech field, they just get a ton more room than we do. And I see that they're advertised everywhere. But I went and looked at podcast advertising just because I was curious. I was like, what would it cost if I wanted to do like a 30-second ad roll on something like Star Talk? And let me tell you, you don't want to know how much it would cost to do a 30-second ad roll on Star Talk. It is silly. So we're not going to be doing anything like that, but I might be able to do something like, you know, some extra Facebook ads for the show and things like that that can bring in a few more subscribers. And obviously, I'm always putting out videos and things like that to spread the word. I actually put a TikTok out last week that did really well. I think it got like 8,000 views and 300 comments or something like that. It was a picture I took of Markarian's chain at 135 millimeters. And I was basically explaining the scale of space to people so they could get a little bit of a better grasp on it, because, you know, people don't really grasp how gigantically huge spaces. And that's what I was trying to just give them, a small glimpse into how big it actually is with that. And I was basically explaining the photo that they were seeing is about the size of your thumbnail if you were to hold it at arm's length up at the sky. And you can see like just tons of galaxies and stars in this photo. And I said, you know, every irregular smudge that you see on this image is another galaxy. And I said, now imagine your thumbnail. How many thumbnails would it take to cover the entire night sky in both the northern and southern hemisphere? And then I posed the question, okay, now how many smudges do you think are on this picture? And then I minimized the picture, and beneath it is the annotated version from PixInsight, which shows the NGC catalog, the new general catalog, which is, you know, basically the named galaxies. And it's just ridiculous. There's thousands and thousands of galaxies in that one image. And that's what we see everywhere when we look in any direction. That was the entire point of, you know, Hubble Deep Field, because we looked somewhere where we thought there was nothing. And lo and behold, there's galaxies everywhere. And that's literally everywhere in the night sky. So it's pretty cool. I like being able to, you know, drop a little bit of knowledge on people who might not know otherwise, considering how much hate science gets these days. And, you know, there's unfortunately a lot of people out there who don't believe the most basic truths of science anymore. So we got to combat that a little bit and spread a little bit of awareness and truth and, you know, just put it out there that, yes, the universe is real. Yes, galaxies are real. Yes, the Earth is round, et cetera, et cetera. So if I can do a little bit of that and reach more listeners, then that's what I will do. So thanks so much. If you want to join Patreon, that's patreon.com/theastrocast. So I'll have that link for you guys in the show notes. I've got a pretty cool recommendation for you this week. I've been listening to a couple of new books. I'm not going to give you both of them this week just because I'll probably save the other one for next week's recommendation because they're both really, really good. But this is one that I've been thinking about picking up for a long time, but I didn't pick it up because it's not as long as the normal books that I listen to. And I'm a cheapskate. And I feel like if the book's not at least, you know, 15 hours long, then I'm not getting my money's worth, which is kind of a silly reason not to buy a book. But that's me. But Audible had a 2-for-1 sale and it was listed on there. So I ended up getting two of the books that I wanted for one credit. So if you're an Audible subscriber, you could probably still get the deal. Anyway, the book is Letters from an Astrophysicist by Neil deGrasse Tyson. So this book is his correspondence for several years before he kind of became ridiculously famous. So he was still pretty famous when he was writing these letters back and forth, but he still had a public email address that went directly to him. When he was the director of the, he still is the director of the Hayden Planetarium, but when he still had a public email address, basically, that was accessible to anyone who wanted to write him an email. And it's all of his responses to basically anyone who would ask him a question. And the topics are huge and range widely. So they're kind of all over the place. He covers everything from black holes to Bigfoot to UFOs and religion and everything in between. But it's really, really good. If you like Neil deGrasse Tyson, you'll love this book. He narrates it. They have other narrators who read the letters, the two, and then obviously he reads the response. It's really well done. I like it because I can listen to it in short bursts. So, you know, if I'm just like running up to the store and I only have 5 minutes, I can, you know, get a good chunk of it in and then, you know, set it back down. I like books like that where I can listen for 5 minutes at a time and still feel like I, you know, got some good entertainment out of it. So excellent, excellent book. So you could pick it up as a read, obviously. I like the audiobook. Neil deGrasse Tyson has an excellent voice. So highly recommend that. That'll be this week's recommendation. Also wanted to briefly mention, I finally got to test out the L-Extreme F2 filter. So when I told you earlier in the episode at the beginning that I woke up at 4:30 in the morning and came outside, I was imaging the Sator region with that F2 L-Extreme filter. And man, it did a really good job. So I got all of the Sator region and the Crescent Nebula and 1 3-minute exposure at F2 kind of blew my other telescope out of the water with the L-Pro. So I was kind of shocked by that. The nebulosity is ridiculous on that thing. So I didn't do anything like a 10-minute or 20-minute exposure like I know you can do with that, just because I don't really feel it necessary, I guess you could say. And I don't know what the well depth is on my camera either. I should probably look that up at some point, but I know that there is diminishing returns after you get to a certain point. But anyway, the filter is awesome and it is indeed as good as advertised. I didn't see any halo effects at all on my stars. I haven't fully processed the photo yet. I only saw the auto stretch subs that came out on the ASI Air, obviously, but they looked great. So I can't wait to go ahead and process that image and see how it comes out. A few mornings ago when I was also up super early, or actually, you know, I wasn't up super early. I was up super late. I didn't go to bed till about 4:30 in the morning on Saturday night into Sunday morning. I tried to image the Blue Horsehead Nebula. Yeah, that was a bad idea from my Bortle nearly 7 front yard. Don't try that if you're not in a very, very dark sky. I also had my L-Pro on and I read later that you really shouldn't use that. You should just use a UV IR cut filter because it's a reflection nebula and the type of nebulosity that you're trying to pick up is a very faint blue nebula, obviously, because it's the Blue Horsehead Nebula. But apparently even the L-Pro can cut out some of the wavelength that you're trying to pick up. And then you can't use tools like Graxpert to extract the gradient very well because it'll end up taking out some of the signal. Long story short, I got about 2 hours on it before I was completely exhausted. I ran it through PixInsight the next day just because I had to see. I was able to pick up the shape. I could tell what it was, but it is not anything that I'm going to show off because it was ugly. That being said, that is one of the targets that I'm going to be shooting when I go to the Dark Sky trip in June, which is just 55 days away at this point. I'm very excited. Sorry, a mosquito just bit me. So if you heard me slapping, that was why. I got the garage door open because it's kind of hot today and I can't run my air conditioner when I'm recording. And then something just bit me. So that's just wonderful. So I am getting bit. And I think we've just about covered everything for this week. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up today's episode. I want to thank everybody so much for joining us again this week. I am your host, Rue. I want to thank you guys for joining us again this week on the AstroCast. I will be back next week, and I'm going to do my best to get the PixInsight episode together. Again, I'm putting together the research for that so I can get a thorough tutorial together so we can do it the right way. Thanks for hanging out with me and talking for about an hour. Again, I'm your host, Rue, out in Charlotte. Enjoy your week and have clear skies. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, well, you've come to the right place. This is a super fun guilty pleasure one that I like to listen to every now and then, hosted by Jeremy Corbell and George Knapp. It is called Weaponized. So these guys look into UFO sightings and government cover-ups, etc., etc. It's pretty cool. I don't know their specific prior job titles. I believe one of them was actually involved with the government, and that's kind of their shtick. But if you like conspiracy theories and UFOs and all that sort of stuff, it's a fun one to listen to. So give that a try. If you're not interested, throw it in the trash pile, but I enjoy it occasionally. So maybe you will too. Thanks again. Clear skies.